tune in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is conducting a survey, and we want to hear from you. Your valuable feedback about KBOO will help shape the types of public affairs, news, and music programming we bring you and our community in the years ahead. We're also interested in how you listen to KBOO, and we'll use this feedback to help serve you better. The survey is anonymous, however, you will have an opportunity to provide your contact information to enter a drawing. 10 lucky winners will receive a $50 gift card. The survey is open now, and the deadline to participate has been extended to Sunday, July 30th. Go to our website at kboo.fm/survey23. kboo.fm/survey23. Thank you in advance for your time and your feedback. Stay tuned for KBOO's next strategic plan coming soon.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we're going to summarize some of the big stories in science and politics. Leading off, a story concerns the origin of humanity. Did Darwin get it right as to say where humans originally came from? Well, the latest evidence using DNA analysis shows that, well, Darwin almost got it right in terms of where did Homo sapiens first originate from. And then we'll say something about the bottom of the ocean. The world, of course, was horrified by the images coming from the bottom of the ocean, where we had a submersible that collapsed on its way to photograph as a tourist attraction the Titanic wreckage. And so the question is, what went wrong? Is it illegal to have a tourist attraction to take tourists down to the very bottom of the Atlantic Ocean without looking at all the things that could go wrong? Well, we'll talk about the science and the engineering of going to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. And then from the bottom of the ocean to outer space, the Webb telescope has given us some sensational photographs of different kinds of galaxies out there, planets, and even radiation emitted from the earliest days of the creation of the universe. But some people have said, now, wait a minute, the Hubble Space Telescope pictures, weren't they brighter, more sensational, more colorful? Some of the Webb telescope pictures look, well, they're historic, but they look kind of bland. Why is that? And we'll say the reason why it is because the Webb Space Telescope is not like the Hubble. The Webb Space Telescope is a Big Bang telescope, specifically designed to pick up radiation from the earliest times of the creation of the universe itself. And that's why some of the photographs tend to be on the dark side. And then we'll say a few things on the medical front. You know, there's a relationship that was not quite understood for quite a while concerning what is called REM sleep disorder and Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease. Well, REM disorder is a sleep disorder where you have nightmares and you act them out at night. And it turns out there's a causal link, apparently, between those people, usually elderly males, who have REM sleep disorders and Parkinson's disease. And now scientists are beginning to understand the molecular link between these and perhaps find a way one day to cure, let's hope, to cure Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease. And of course, when we talk about sleep disorders, we're also going to talk about UFOs and people who claim they've been abducted by aliens in outer space. Well, let's just jump right into some of the big stories of the past week. Scientists are now closing in on the origin of Homo sapiens. First of all, it was Charles Darwin who was the first one to point to Africa. He said that Africa is the place where humans first evolved. You see, Darwin reasoned that because of evolution, the place where humans originated should also have different branches of the human tree. In other words, there should be lots of different kinds of varieties of apes where we came from. Now, if you take a map of the world and you say to yourself, where do we find the largest collection of apes or ape-like creatures that look like us? Well, it would have to be Africa. And so Charles Darwin said that's where humanity first originated from because of his theory of evolution. Well, then the next question is, how many people back then gave rise to the human race? Well, it was once thought that perhaps one tribe was the ancestral tribe that gave birth to the human race. But that was when we didn't have DNA analysis. We didn't have the metrics. We didn't have the data by which to zero in on where humanity came from. Now we have a new report coming out just a few months ago stating that they've solved the problem. It turns out that Charles Darwin was not quite right. We're not talking about one tribe that gave birth to the entire human race. We're talking about a sequence of multiple tribes, a collection of them. DNA went back and forth between this cluster of tribes, and that is the evidence coming from DNA analysis. We don't see a clear line of DNA going all the way back to 150 to 200,000 years ago. No, it's much more complicated than that, which meant that early humans coexisted with other early humans, and there was interbreeding between these different tribes. Now, that doesn't mean that there wasn't an ancestral Eve or an ancestral Adam. Given a tree, you have all these branches that intertwine with each other, and it means that it's possible that there could have been one woman, an ancestral Eve, that gave birth to the entire human race. That's still possible, but it also means that there were many other Eves as well, because there was a cluster of these tribes, according to this theory, that gave rise to the human race. And so we think we now have a DNA evidence that points to the fact that, well, Darwin got it almost right, the fact that there was a cluster of tribes that intermarried, shared their DNA, that eventually gave rise to Homo sapiens. And let's talk about some of the other things in the news. And the question is submersibles. Submersibles that take tourists down to see the Titanic. Are they safe? Or are they really underwater coffins that could collapse, killing everyone on board? Well, that academic question became part of reality and the headlines because of the fact that we lost the submersible with paying tourists on board. Well, now engineers and physicists are combing over the data. And what they find, well, what they find won't be published for a few more weeks to months, but the preliminary evidence points to the fact that most likely the submersible that was sent down to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean was defective. Defective in several ways. First of all, instead of using titanium, which is the metal of choice for those individuals that are creating submersibles that can go to the very bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, the designers use carbon fibers. Now, it turns out the carbon fibers are not as strong as titanium, especially under the pressures involved. How much pressure is involved? Take a square inch of your submersible and then calculate how much pressure is on that square inch, and it comes out to be several tons of pressure per square inch. So imagine a submersible with a series of Mack trucks sitting on top of it, and you can begin to understand the enormous pressures that exist there. Second of all, because they didn't use a titanium hull, they had a piece of the hull made of titanium and the rest of it made out of carbon fibers. The joint is perhaps the weak link because the joints expand and contract at different rates. Therefore, the joint between titanium and the carbon fibers is probably, we don't know for sure, probably where the break first occurred because they contract at different rates under different temperatures, under different pressures. So what does it mean? It means that safety comes first. And the people who designed this submersible even admitted that, yes, they were cutting corners because they thought there was no harm in doing so. Now we realize that you can't cheat the laws of physics. You can't cheat the laws of mechanics. When you are suffering under several tons of pressure per square inch, there is no margin for error whatsoever. That's a word to the wise. And let's now go from the bottom of the ocean to outer space. The Webb Space Telescope is living up to expectations. We now have a telescope that examines not just the visible and ultraviolet regions of outer space, but also the infrared regions of outer space. Now, why is that important? Because radiation from the Big Bang has been stretched since it was first emerged 13 or so billion years ago. When you take light and you stretch it, it starts to get lower and lower in frequency. In other words, visible light turns slightly reddish or infrareddish as you expand it. Now, the Webb Space Telescope was specifically designed to pick up radiation from the Big Bang. The radiation from the Big Bang has been stretched, therefore visible light would be stretched into the infrared, and that's the reason why the Webb Space Telescope pictures tend to be darker than the Hubble Space pictures. But the resolution of the Webb Space Telescope pictures is much finer than the resolution of the Hubble Space Telescope. And more importantly, the Hubble Space Telescope cannot peer into the infrared region. That's the most important region when you want to discuss the creation of the universe itself. That's where the Webb Space Telescope excels beyond the capability of the Hubble Space Telescope. And also, news on the medical front. It's been known for a while that there seems to be a correlation between people who suffer from sleep disorder and Parkinson's disease. So let's break it down. This mainly affects elderly males, but of course it could also affect women as well. These are individuals that have nightmares. They act out nightmares at night. They yell, they scream, they get into fights all while they're asleep. And when they wake up, they have no memories of that. This is called REM sleep disorder. And it's been known for a while, but now there's a connection to Parkinson's disease. It turns out that people who have REM sleep disorder have a propensity to eventually come down with Parkinson's disease, which is disease like Alzheimer's disease, which could be debilitating. And the question is, why? What's the link? It's at first you may think there's no possible link between these. And yes, there is a link. The link is dopamine. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that the brain has to use. Now, it turns out that when the level of dopamine begins to fall, that's when you start to have the symptoms of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, and many of the diseases of the elderly. So what's the link? It could be dopamine. It turns out that people with REM sleep disorder also have a problem with dopamine, and that's where it first starts. You see, people with REM sleep disorder can come down with a disease years before Parkinson's or Alzheimer's disease sets in. It could be an early warning system. Now, the next question is, what do you do if you think you have REM sleep disorder? Well, first of all, you have to get a correct diagnosis. So, in other words, talk to your sleeping partner. It turns out that people who have REM sleep disorder tend to act out violently their dreams and their nightmares, and they often tend to injure their bedmate. So the first thing you can do is simply talk to your bedmate to find out whether or not you exhibit the symptoms of REM sleep disorder. Then you can be tested. Yes, you can go to sleep under controlled conditions, and scientists can then photograph and check your blood pressure and things like that as you undergo these episodes to see whether or not this is REM sleep disorder or just a fluke. And then what do you do about it? Well, there's no cure for it. However, melatonin, which is a chemical that many people take to go to sleep at night, for example, actually does help. And so that's not a cure by any means, but it's one way perhaps to ameliorate the fact that you become violent without your permission late at night. Now, at the beginning of this commentary, I mentioned that there was a link between REM sleep disorder and the UFO phenomenon. Well, what could possibly be the link between these two very distinct things? Well, first of all, let's take a look at the alien abduction scenario. Many people that have claimed to be abducted by aliens from outer space tell the same story, that they're in a dream state, that they're glued to the platform or the bed sheet on which they're resting, and the aliens are hovering over them, performing experiments on their sex organs, and no matter how hard they try, they are unable to escape. Well, that's the commonality of all these different kinds of testimonials. Now, let's break it down. First of all, we don't know for sure what really happened. So we have to leave open the possibility that, well, maybe it really happened. But let's say, for example, that it was an example of REM sleep disorder. REM sleep disorder is not found in the average person. The average person shuts down your body's muscles when you dream, because if you act out your dream, you could injure somebody and injure yourself. Therefore, the average person is paralyzed. The average person is paralyzed when they dream. Now, let's say you have REM sleep disorder. This means that when you are awake, you are actually in a dream state where you are, part of your brain is awake, part of your brain is not awake, but you still have the ability to act out your nightmare. So in other words, perhaps the episode of alien abduction is REM sleep disorder. So the scenarios are identical. That is, you're lying on a bed, you're slightly sexually excited, because that's what happens under REM sleep disorder. Experiments are being done without your permission. You are paralyzed, you can't move, but you are awake. That's exactly the symptoms of REM sleep disorder. Now, does that mean that alien abduction scenarios are all fake? No. I'm a scientist. We have to be open to all sorts of strange, bizarre concepts. We need data. We need evidence. That's what we need. So when people tell me that they've been in a flying saucer and they've been abducted by aliens from outer space, I tell them the same thing. And that is, the next time you are kidnapped by a flying saucer, for God's sake, steal something. I don't care whether it's an alien pen, an alien pencil, an alien chip, steal something. There's no law on the books that says you can't steal from an extraterrestrial civilization. No law whatsoever. And you can have bragging rights because you'll have a souvenir from your trip to outer space, compliments of aliens from another planet. So steal something. Then you'll have verifiable evidence. And then the last question about UFOs I get is, well, after everything is said and done, what about your opinion, Mr. Smarty Pants? What do you think is causing all these strange lights in the sky? Well, I'm a scientist, and we believe in data. The more data, the better. That's the dividing line between hearsay and getting closer and closer to the truth. So far, the data, unfortunately, has been inconclusive. Now, we have tons of different kinds of scenarios, different kinds of eyewitness accounts, but the actual footage of sightings of UFOs comes from the military. And the military data is being looked at very carefully. The physicists at the University of Albany, for example, are looking very carefully, looking at the metrics, that is, the velocity, the acceleration, the trajectory of these objects to see whether or not they conform with the known laws of physics and the known laws of aerodynamics. The preliminary evidence seems to indicate that, well, these things are out of this world. They can go between Mach 2 to Mach 20 effortlessly, zipping across the night sky. They can zigzag, creating G-forces in the hundreds of Gs, enough to crush any living person inside a UFO. And they can go underwater. They can hover and then splash down underwater. And so these things are beyond our capabilities. But, say the cynics, there's always the possibility that it's a mistake. It's a glitch. It's a glitch in our sensing equipment. Perhaps the effects are caused by different kinds of optical illusions. That has to be taken into consideration. So after everything is said and done, my personal point of view is go where the data goes. Now recently, of course, there have been stories saying that up to 12 different kinds of flying saucers have been captured by the military, that we have the alien bodies, and these are Air Force officials that have said that, yes, they've seen the bodies, they've seen the alien craft. But the problem is, no one has stepped forward. It's all secondary hearsay. So we got to get it from the horse's mouth. We got to get it from an Air Force official who will swear the Bible or whatever and say that, yes, he's seen the dead bodies, he's seen the wreckage, yes, the flying saucer phenomenon is real. That we have not seen yet. That, to me, would be the smoking gun. And when we talk about the major stories in science, we should also point out that scientists are also in the news. First of all, of course, we have J. Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, a man who was a tortured individual, on one hand part genius, on the other hand part administrator, who helped to create the nuclear age. But one story is often neglected, and that is that Oppenheimer was also the father of the black hole. You see, back in 1915, Einstein proposed his theory of gravity. One year later, Dr. Schwarzschild in Germany showed that Einstein's equations allowed for something fantastic, a black hole, an object so intense that light itself could not escape. Well, Einstein thought that this was an anomaly, and he spent many years trying to show that a black hole could never form. And so the 1930s, Einstein published a paper showing that a swirling gas of stellar material could never condense to the point where it would contract and become a black hole. Therefore, even though a black hole was a solution of Einstein's equations, Einstein himself thought that that's not a problem because they could never form. However, J. Robert Oppenheimer and his student showed that, well, Einstein was wrong. At about the same time that Einstein showed that a black hole could not form, Oppenheimer and his student showed that, no, a black hole could form by a mechanism that eluded Einstein, and that is implosion. So we're not talking about a swirling gas of hydrogen that slowly condenses into a black hole. No, that doesn't happen. Einstein was right. But let's say that a large star, so massive that it becomes unstable, implodes on itself. Then you could show that, oh my God, Einstein's equations allow for a black hole. Now this implosion method, it was forgotten for many a decade, but it showed that black holes are in fact possible. And in fact, years later, J. Robert Oppenheimer was faced with another problem, and that is how to detonate a plutonium bomb. Now, uranium bombs, like the Hiroshima bomb, are easy to detonate. You take a small pie-shaped mass of uranium, shoot it into a larger pie piece of uranium, you attain critical mass, and boom, you have the Hiroshima bomb. But plutonium cannot be done this way. You cannot make an atomic bomb by slamming a small piece into a larger piece of plutonium. It doesn't work that way. But then Oppenheimer realized that if you implode a sphere of plutonium, then you could attain critical mass and then you can create the Nagasaki bomb. So in other words, the Nagasaki bomb is a creation of Oppenheimer's theory of black holes. So Oppenheimer was right. Implosion is the method by which you can get a black hole. And implosion was the key to the design of the Nagasaki bomb. We should also point out that Einstein himself has been in the news once again. Every time a letter comes out, a personal letter signed by Einstein, it comes out and it's put up for auction, it generates a tremendous amount of interest and money. A few years ago, a letter from Einstein about God was published, and it fetched $2.9 million. $2.9 million for a simple letter explaining Einstein's position on God. Well, now we have yet another letter. It goes for $125,000, explaining how he looks at organized religion and God. And so, yes, once again, Einstein is in the news because people are curious. What did Einstein believe when it came to the Creator and it came to the universe itself? So then the question is, what was Einstein's opinion about God and religion? Well, let me quote from the letter. The letter says, quote, "The person who is more or less trained in scientific thinking is alien to the religious creation in the original sense of the cosmos, because he applies the standard of causal conditionality to everything. This does not refute the religious attitude, but in a certain sense replaces and supersedes it." So in other words, what Einstein was saying is that there really are, in some sense, two kinds of God. The first kind of God is the personal God, the God that answers prayers, the God that smites the Philistines, the God that gives you Christmas presents during the Christmas season. Einstein did not believe in a personal God, a God that you pray to. He believed in some sense in the God of Spinoza, the God of art of harmony, order, the God that creates this gorgeous universe of ours. And could that universe have been an accident? Einstein didn't quite think so. He once said that he's like a child entering a gigantic library for the first time, a library full of wondrous different kinds of ideas. And all he could do was, well, open the first chapter and read the first page. So in other words, the universe was not an accident. It was not designed in the sense that a personal God says, "Let there be light," and all of a sudden there is light. So Einstein did not believe in a personal God, but he believed in the God of order, the God of harmony, the God that makes this wondrous universe of ours. And he thought there was a pattern, a universality, a purpose behind all this wondrous activity, as exemplified by an equation. Einstein thought that there was an equation, perhaps no more than 1 inch long, that would allow him to, quote, "read the mind of God." That was his dream. He came up with an inch equation that solved the question of gravity. However, he wanted another inch equation which would solve not just gravity, but gravity and the nuclear force and all the other forces of the universe. That was his guiding principle for the last 30 years of his life, chasing after this order, this harmony, this fabled equation that would explain the entire universe. Now, of course, he failed. If you read the notebooks of Einstein, and I've had the pleasure of reading some of his notebooks, you can see all the dead ends that he pursued. He was looking at fantastic mathematical structures which did not correspond to reality. You see, reality is a guide by which you can write equations that point you in the right direction. But Einstein got lost. He got lost in a thicket of equations. And when you read his notes on the unified field theory, you realize that he was onto something. He was onto incredible mathematical structures, but he didn't know how to put it all together. Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we're going to talk about the borders of science. What happens when science becomes the paranormal? What happens when people believe strange things? And what happens? Well, sometimes these strange things turn out to be true. With us today is the leading skeptic, the man who says, bah, humbug, whenever you see these science specials about voodoo and magic and talking to dead people on television. He's Michael Shermer, founder of the Skeptic Society, author of a number of books about the paranormal, and he is a, quote, debunker, unquote. Now, let me be very clear about this. He will also probably say something that will probably offend somebody out there. However, he is the leading skeptic, and that's what he does. He's the one who says, bah, humbug, bunch of nonsense being promoted on television. Well, you can challenge him. The Skeptic Society has a website, so if you don't agree with every position taken by Mr. Shermer, engage him on his website. So once again, our special guest today is Michael Shermer, founder of the Skeptic Society and the Skeptics Magazine, author of a number of books about the paranormal, and he is America's, quote, number one debunker. Well, you decide. Now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Dr. Michael Shermer. He's a regular columnist for a scientific magazine. He's also the publisher of Skeptic Magazine and a founder and director of the International Skeptic Society. So today we are going to be talking about, well, conspiracy theories and stuff you see on television, and also the controversy around evolution. We'll be talking about 9/11 conspiracies. Was the World Trade Center brought down by a conspiracy originating in the United States? And for that matter, how do they do those TV shows that you sometimes see where somebody claims to talk to dead people and spirits? And also, what about the controversy concerning Charles Darwin? The controversy does not exist in Europe, and many Europeans are rather amused that the American people seem to be gripped with this crisis over evolution theory. So once again, we're talking to Dr. Michael Shermer, author of the new book, Why Darwin Matters. The first question for you, Dr. Shermer, is explain to us the skeptics movement.
Well, we started the Skeptic Society and Skeptic Magazine in 1992, but there's been for half a century a skeptical movement that was kind of begun by Martin Gardner and James Randi and others when the whole business about Uri Geller and the spoon-bending psychic stuff was picking up steam in the 70s. That's when the modern skeptical movement really took off. And our magazine, the purpose of it is to, well, two things, really. We are debunkers, let's face it. There's a lot of bunk out there, and part of our job is to like trash collecting. It's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it, and so that's part of it. But to me, that's not the most interesting thing. I mean, like lining up the claims of the creationist or 9/11 conspiracy people or whatever, and answering them one by one is something somebody needs to do, and that is what we do. But on a larger scale, I'm more interested in the power of belief, how belief systems work, how people come to believe such weird things. You know, I mean, I wrote a book about this, why people believe weird things. I mean, it is an interesting question, particularly smart people. I mean, you know, college professors believe weird things. And so how does that happen? I mean, if they're so smart, what's going on here? And the short answer, as it turns out, is that most of our beliefs are held for non-smart reasons, that is, psychological, emotional commitments that we make depending on our peer groups and mentors and where we were raised and the beliefs of our parents and things like that, and then we back up into the beliefs using rational arguments to justify them after we already hold those beliefs. And so that's something I've learned in this job.
And I guess there's no gene for rigorous scientific thinking, right? I mean, no one's born by saying that things have to be falsifiable, testable, reproducible. We humans sort of like grab on to anything that comes along sometimes, right?
Yeah, that's right. We're not natural-born scientists, although we are natural-born causal seekers. I mean, we're pattern-seeking animals. We look to connect the dots A to B to C. And in the natural environment, often those dots are really connected. They really are causally connected, and we're good enough at it to be able to survive and have evolved to where we are now. But the problem is that we make a lot of false positives, these so-called type 1 errors, in which we assume something is real when it's not. And it, generally, it doesn't cost you anything. It doesn't take you out of the gene pool, and to assume that there's something there that isn't, like, let's say, if I spin three times to the left, it'll bring on the rain or be good for fertility or something like this, that doesn't cost me anything. It's not going to take me out of the gene pool. So we've inherited the capacity for superstition and magical thinking. And then it's only one small step from that to also assuming that other agents have intentionality, that is, agents like other animals, other people, other animals. You don't have time on the plains of the savannas of Africa to calculate whether that cheetah or that lion is interested in you or not. The safest thing to do is just always assume he has intention, and the intentions are bad. And so run like hell. And so if all agents have intention, which is an easy assumption to make, then it's a small step to assuming so does the inanimate world, planets, rocks, trees, the lightning, clouds, they all have intention too. And something with intention is an agent, a being, a god, if you will. So there you see how we get from animism to polytheism to monotheism. That is, we assume that there's some causal agent in the universe at work, and that today we call God, but other people in other times call it something else.
Now, I understand that some brain scientists have looked at something called epileptic lesions, damage to the brain, whereby people see causal things everywhere in the universe if they suffer from epileptic lesions. If it rains, it's because they did something bad the other day. It's a punishment. Mm-hmm. Almost anything around them has some kind of supernatural causal basis to it. And this can actually be induced artificially, I understand.
Yeah, this is the work of several scientists. Ramachandran at UC San Diego does stuff on temporal lobe seizures and how that generates incredibly intense religious experiences, including the hearing of voices and whatnot. There's a guy named Michael Persinger at Laurentian University who puts this helmet on your head and bombards your temporal lobes with electromagnetic patterns, waves of patterns, and he's able to generate, very, very mild, generate out-of-body experiences and the sense presence in the room. You're in this little isolation room that's completely quiet. And so by doing that, he hopes to try to replicate how it is that some people have these remarkable experiences. But I don't think that explains why people believe in God, because the average person who says they believe in God, you know, 92% of Americans say they believe in God, most of them don't hear voices. They're not talking to angels. You know, they're not sensing aliens or angels coming into their room and nothing like that. They believe because they were raised to believe. They were raised in a Christian culture. Most of their parents are religious, and that's why most people believe. It has to do with psychology and culture more than anything else.
And also, you said it doesn't take you out of the gene pool to believe in these things, but doesn't it actually strengthen your chance of survival to complete the dots? I mean, if you think you see a tiger in the forest, you complete the dots, and you say, oh, there's a tiger there, right?
Yeah, that's right.
But 9 times out of 10, there's no tiger.
Yeah.
There's no face on Mars. There's no Donald Duck in the clouds in the sky. But the brain says, by God, it looks like Disney characters up in the sky. And the brain does that naturally because, in some sense, 1 time out of 10, it actually probably saves your butt, right?
That's right. So magical thinking and superstitious thinking is actually just part of a larger, what I call a belief engine. That is, we just form causal connections and beliefs about everything. And sometimes they're true. They're true often enough that it helps us. But the rest of the time that they're not true, the false positives, so what? It doesn't really hurt us. So we've inherited that. It's never going to go away. I have job security at Skeptic.
Okay.
People will always be believing weird things.
Uh-huh. Okay. And let me ask you a personal question. Why get into this business? Because it's a thankless job. You probably get a lot of angry letters from fans of Bigfoot. You probably get a lot of angry people saying, how dare you question whatever. It's a thankless job. Why do it?
Well, I do get some of those letters, but I get far more letters thanking me from scientists in particular who appreciate what we do on the fringes of science there and defending science and science education. And, you know, it's like they don't have time to do it. Scientists are busy doing their science, and so somebody has to do this. And also we're constructing a whole worldview, a scientific worldview, scientism, if you will. And in a sense, it's not an all-encompassing thing, but it does attempt to give some spiritual meaning to people's lives who don't believe in God. That is, I think, if spirituality is a way of being in the world in which you have a sense of awe and wonder about things bigger than you, what does that better than science? I mean, a Hubble Space Telescope photograph of the expanding galaxies and all that, wow, that's just incredibly awe-inspiring. So that's another thing that we do, is to try to be there for people as a resource that, you know, hey, there's other people out here who embrace this scientific worldview.
Okay. Let's move on to some other topics, because your organization, of course, handles everything. What about those people on television at night getting a lot of response that say they can talk to dead people? And it's quite dramatic. You see them out there in front of an audience, and afterwards there are tears and crying and sobbing as the family members say, yes, 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 we thank you so much. You have given us insight into our dearly beloved who just passed away.
Yeah.
Well, what are your thoughts about talking to dead people?
Right. Well, it turns out anybody can talk to dead people. It's getting the dead people to talk back that's the hard part.
I see.
And that's all they're doing, really. Really, it's a show. It's a type of psychic, it's a type of magic called cold reading, mentalism, where you pretend or you fake or you appear to be talking to dead people. You appear to be getting information from the other side is what it is, and it's a trick. So, first of all, the people are prepped. They're ready. They're there because they want it to be true. So that makes it especially easy. Then you don't have to get a lot of hits. In fact, you only need to get about 1 out of 10 statements. We've done a lot of studies on these. In the course of a one-hour reading, half-hour reading, whatever, a psychic will say hundreds of things, 200 to 300 different comments and questions. And if they only get, say, half a dozen to a dozen right, the person going away is completely convinced. They'll come away and go, that's unbelievable. He got the name of my uncle, George, who passed over. Yeah, but if you actually look at the tape, he went through half a dozen to a dozen names before he got to George, or he didn't even say George. He said, I'm getting some sort of a father figure. Who is this, please? And then the person will say, oh, that's my uncle, George. He passed over. And then the guy will come back and say, like 10 minutes later, go, no, I'm getting somebody here. Don't tell me his name. It feels like an uncle. Is his name George? And the person will fall over just completely shocked that the psychic was able to get this. But in fact, he didn't get it. They gave it to him. That's very typical of these kinds of things. So it's a trick. It's called cold reading. Anybody can do it with a little bit of practice, and nobody can talk to the dead.
And also the audience, aren't they a little bit selfish? I mean, they want something. What they want is forgiveness because this person passed away with unresolved problems. And they want that reassuring statement then from on heaven, these people forgive you. And that's why they break down and sob.
Yes.
So isn't the audience, aren't they in some sense an unconscious partner in this whole thing, in the sense that they want something? They want forgiveness.
Yep. There's unsolved. Actually, if you do these things, I've done a couple of readings for TV shows and stuff. I always say something like that. There's some unfinished business here, isn't there? And the people, they cry, oh, yes, that's right. I wanted to tell him that I loved him. Something like that. Or, you know, I wrecked his car. I owe him money. I want forgiveness for sin. Something like that. But even more so, it's just sort of odd that if the dead really wanted to talk to us, why would they come up with the most inane things? Like, he's telling me something about a red dress, or he's giving me his name. His name? He already knows his name. She knows his name. Can't we move on to something a little more important about the unfinished business? There are always these trivial little things, and that tells us that it's phony.
And also, if you can really talk to the dead and understand their secrets, you'd know where buried treasure is located. You know where all sorts of riches and wealth can be found.
I always ask these guys, tell me where, talk to Jimmy Hoffa and ask him where his body is. You know, where is the body, Jimmy? Because
right.
He would know, right?
I suppose he would know, right?
I would hope so.
Okay, well, moving on. Your organization, of course, talks about a lot of things, so let's quickly just do a few things, like Bigfoot or Bermuda Triangle. Quickly, What does your organization say about those people who think there really is something to Bigfoot? Or
well, in this case, it's not impossible. There might be a bipedal hominid roaming the hinterlands of the northeastern, northwestern United States. Who knows? But in biology, in order to name a new species, you have to have a type specimen, a holotype, a specimen that can be photographed, dissected, passed around, put in a museum, studied by other scientists. That's how you name a new species. You can't just do it based on blurry photographs and grainy videos and anecdotes about weird things that go bump in the night. That doesn't constitute naming a new species, discovering a new species. So what I say to them is show me the body. And until then, it's reasonable to be skeptical.
And also the famous videotape of Bigfoot walking away from the camera.
Yeah.
There's a man who claims that he is that man in the monkey suit.
The guy in the ape suit, yeah.
And he claims how he did it. He goes into quite a bit of detail. He knew the people who first surfaced with the tape. He was good friends with them. And he says that the three of them went into the forest, and he was basically afraid that some hunter would kill him because he was running around in a monkey suit. And that's why they, of course, didn't have that much footage of him, because he didn't want to be shot at.
Yep, that's right. Well, that's, you know, sometimes people claim hoaxes, they don't actually do them. But I think it's possible in that case he actually did. It certainly does look like a guy in an ape suit, clearly. But, you know, there's no smoking gun. No one's turned up the actual ape suit yet, so we'll see.
And what about the Bermuda Triangle?
Well, there you have an effect where all these wrecks allegedly happens to be the area where there's probably the most shipping traffic in the world and the worst storms and hurricanes in the world. So just by that alone, you're going to get a lot of unusual seafaring accidents and things like that. If you control for the baseline of how many accidents you would expect for that amount of traffic and that kind of weather, it turns out nothing unusual happens.
Okay, and what about alien abductions? Some people claim that it is nothing but sleep paralysis involved, but explain.
That's the best theory we have going now. That is, we do know that a certain percentage of the population, maybe 1 out of 50 or so, has sleep paralysis. That is, you wake up in the middle of the night in which you're so relaxed, you feel paralyzed, like you can't move. You're not actually awake. You're sort of in a dreamlike state, but you feel like you're awake. But your body is prone and seemingly paralyzed. You can't move. And then you have a sense presence in the room and a feeling of something like comes into the room and sits on your body, sits on your chest. Middle Ages, they called these the night crusher. The crusher that comes in the night. This is a nightmare is what it was, a nightmare. And then they called them incubi and succubi. These were, you know, demons. Satan sent them in. And 100 years ago, it was ghosts and the poltergeists that came into the room. And today, it's aliens. And so the culture tells you what you're supposed to interpret that odd brain anomaly as. So it's a mental phenomenon. It's a brain anomaly. And then the culture tells you what you're supposed to call it or interpret it or how the narrative is supposed to be constructed. Since we live in the age of science and science fiction and Star Trek and E.T. and so on, that's our angels.
Now, I understand. I once interviewed a sleep expert. He said that when we dream, we are paralyzed. We're paralyzed when we dream. Otherwise, we sleepwalk and create all sorts of mischief.
Yeah.
However, there are these people, 1 in 50 or so, who, when they wake up, they're in this dream state where they are paralyzed, but they're conscious, semi-conscious.
Yes.
And then they have these, you know, nightmare recollections under hypnosis, which brings this out.
That's right. And there is a small percentage also who don't have that, but they have recovered memories of being abducted. And we know now that recovered memories are completely unreliable. They're brought forth by therapists who already believe in aliens and ask them leading questions. And then in the hypnotic sessions, they construct false memories in their own minds of things that actually never happened. And we now know that that's really easy to do.
And isn't that how people say that if you get hypnotized, you can go back to the days of Julius Caesar, and why people claim that they are actually Mark Anthony or Cleopatra reincarnated? Because the therapist evokes images of ancient Egypt and the movie Cleopatra.
That's right. Why is it that no one, with reincarnation, no one ever comes back and says, well, you know, I was a shoe shiner.
Or mass murderer.
Yeah, mass murderer. I was a grave digger. I was a nobody. I didn't do anything.
You're always Cleopatra.
Yeah,
right?
It's always something kind of sexy and cool.
Right. Okay, let's now move on to the subject of your book tour. You must be on a very grueling book tour right now.
Yeah, doing the West Coast, the next month, the East Coast, basically just giving lectures and doing media interviews on why Darwin matters.
Okay. Now, if you go to Europe, many Europeans are amazed that Americans are still fixated over this the monkey trial of many decades ago. It's a settled question in Europe. In fact, Darwin is on the money in England.
Yes, I know.
However, here it's quite a volatile issue. Why here and not in Europe?
Well, in part because we have separation of church and state, and that drives churches to be much more aggressive in their pursuit of their religion. And the kind of religion practiced here tends to be more fundamentalist, more literalist in its interpretation. Now, mind you, this is still they're still a minority, but they're a vocal minority, and they're a vocal minority that have money and therefore some political clout. So they're a lot more vocal than they actually are powerful, but nevertheless, they're there. And so the four strategies they've developed since the Scopes Trial. The first strategy was banning the teaching of evolution, and that resulted in the Scopes Trial. The second strategy in the 60s after Sputnik and the reintroduction of science into and Darwin into public school classrooms brought forth demands for equal time for Darwin and Genesis, and they lost all those battles on First Amendment grounds. Third strategy, 70s and 80s, was to demand equal time for evolution science and creation science. They just put a hyphen and stuck the word on the end as if that makes it science. And they lost those battles, including all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1987, where the nine justices voted 7-2 to uphold the Louisiana ban on equal time laws. And that killed creationism once and for all, or so I thought. But as it goes, creationism keeps evolving and mutating in new species, which it's not supposed to be able to do. And in the 1990s arose this intelligent design movement, which is not your father's creationism. It's much more sophisticated. It's done by guys with PhDs, some of whom actually have academic jobs, and they write books that are much more sophisticated than the old creationist books. And they have an agenda called the wedge, in which they want to break down the wedge separating church and state, and it begins with the secular materialistic worldview, which they believe is embodied in science in general and Darwin in particular. So that's where they got this idea, is we have to topple Darwin and the theory of evolution to begin our long program of reintroducing Christianity into American public life. That is their goal. So whenever somebody pretends to be doing science, that's our bailiwick. That's what the skeptics do. We jump in there and say, okay, let's see your evidence. And so my book, I actually have a whole long chapter in which I have all of their arguments, the top 10 arguments they present and the counters to them. And then I go on from there exploring their agenda and their motives and so on.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of those. Some of the creationists claim that humans coexisted with the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs were wiped out by the flood, that the world is only 6,000 years old. But what are your thoughts, and what are some of their best arguments?
Now, on that, the modern intelligent design creationists, they don't believe any of that you just said. Those are young Earth creationists. They have purposely distanced themselves from them so that they can make more make more ground in public schools. So they say, no, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. We recognize that. Evolution does happen. It's microevolution, not macroevolution. And the flood was a mythic story. It didn't literally happen. So by doing that, they've been able to curry a lot of favor amongst more thoughtful intellectual people who do read the Bible more allegorically and metaphorically than literally. So their best arguments have to do with biology, and particularly the structure of DNA, the structure of the eye, the blood clotting mechanism, the bacterial flagellum, the little tail that, like on a sperm cell, a little tail like that, that propels cells, and any kind of complex molecular biological structure or function that they don't think Darwin or Darwinian theory can explain, that's where they think the intelligent designer stepped into our space and time and tweaked the system to get that going. That's their core belief.
And what is their best shot? If you were to try to tear down Darwin using that point of view, what is their best shot?
Their best shot is to try to find and Darwin himself said this in The Origin of Species, if somebody could show where it would be impossible to have a stepwise, gradual buildup of a structure or function, then my theory would be shot. So that's what they're always looking for. They call this irreducible complexity, some sort of system in which if you took out one part, it wouldn't work anymore, therefore it's irreducibly complex structure that can't work without all the parts. Therefore, how would a stepwise, gradual Darwinian method system build, say, an eye or a wing? Let's just take the wing, because that's such a classic one. We can certainly see what a fully functioning wing would do for an organism. It's adaptively functional. It's great for getting away from predators, catching prey, and so on. But what good would half a wing do, or 10% of a wing? How do you go from zero wing to 1% of a wing, all the way up to 100% of a fully functioning wing? Until you get to 100%, you can't fly. The answer is that it was not a poorly adapted wing along the way. It was a well-adapted something else, that something else being probably a thermoregulating device. Wings are terrific for gathering, collecting heat or holding heat in next to the body. Wings are also terrific for, like in penguins, to use as submarine devices, that is, for controlling motion through the water. Wings are also good for, as it turns out, animals that are running along the ground, particularly if they're going uphill, can go faster if they push with their wings along the ground or just push the air back. They don't actually have to achieve flight at all. They get a terrific advantage for running speed. And we know about already gliding squirrels, for example. You don't have to have fully functioning flapping wings. You can use ersatz wings for gliding. And all of those are stepwise ways that you can get from no wing to fully functioning flying wing, because they were used for something else and then later co-opted for the current use that we see.
And what about the eye?
The eye, it's not true that the human eye is irreducibly complex. If you took out any one part, it wouldn't work at all. That's not true. Lots of people have various vision disorders in which they can only see partially, but they can see partially, and believe me, they'd rather see partially than not at all. It does give them some advantage. So it's not true. In any case, if you look at just the current animal kingdom, you will find a whole sequence of eyes from the simplest you can imagine, a single eye spot on a very simple organism in which its only job is to turn on or off if there's any kind of light at all, to a handful of eye spots, to a little pit that has a whole bunch of eye cells, that is light-sensitive cells, that give a tiny bit of directionality to the light, to a deeper eye pit, in which you get kind of a crude image forming. There's no lens yet, but a crude image forming on the pit that has all these light-sensitive cells, and all the way up to the modern mammalian complex eye. So there is already a stepwise sequence just in current animals, and you can reconstruct how that could have happened from the fossil record.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Our special guest was Michael Shermer, founder of the Skeptic Society. So, good day for exploration.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/kboo.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/kboo radio.
We also provide content to the free music archive.
An interactive library of high-quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/KBOO.
You can find all of this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
¶¶
Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross from KGUA FM, Walla, California. When I'm in Portland, which is often, I listen to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your FM
dial. How much is that golden doodle or adorable Frenchie in the window? Probably a lot, especially in terms of suffering for its parents, who in many cases are living lives of misery in a puppy mill. On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll be talking with Robert Hensley, senior counsel for the ASPCA, about their push to pass Goldie's Act, a bill now in Congress that would ensure better conditions and oversight for the hundreds of thousands of dogs now suffering at the hands of large-scale dog breeders.
The dog that Goldie's Act is named for was one of the dogs that lived in squalor and tragically was allowed to starve to death over several months while USDA inspectors observed her deteriorating condition.